This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. If one wanted to make a pilgrimage to the cultural touchstones of America, you would be required to make a stop at 706 Union Avenue in Memphis, Tennessee. That's the Memphis Recording Service Studios, also known as Sun Studios. It was at that storefront that rock and roll was born. Had disc jockey Sam Phillips not started his venture to capture the sounds of Beale Street and the South, we might not have heard of or heard from Elvis Presley, Howlin' Wolf, Ike Turner, Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, Roy Orbison, Carl Perkins, B.B. King, and others. Phillips was a music producer that changed America. So what was it about Phillips that drove him to reach across racial barriers, push singers to dig deep, and hear what no one else could hear? The story is told in the book. Sam Phillips, the man who invented rock and roll, the author Peter Guralnick writes it. And Peter, welcome to The Source.
Well, thanks. Great to be here.
What was Sam Phillips, what was his business plan when he opened up the Memphis Recording Service?
To provide an opportunity for some of the great Negro artists in the South, and Negro being a term of respect, who have no other place to go. That was his entire purpose. His greater goal, it was because of his admiration for artists like John Lee Hooker, Lightnin' Hopkins, because of the sounds that he heard working in the fields as a kid on the farm, the 323-acre farm outside of Florence, Alabama, that his father rented and lost with the Depression, working beside black and white sharecroppers. I mean, a 7- or 8-year-old Sam Phillips was because of the sounds he heard coming out of the black church. But his greater goal, and this was a matter of conviction that I think is unique. I mean, there was a lot of this kind of thing in the air, obviously. Nobody invented anything. Nothing comes from nothing. But the point with Sam is long before he opened his studio on January 2nd, 1950, long before he even imagined what form this was going to take, he believed to the core of his soul that once a mainstream audience heard the music that had so inspired him, once they heard the gospel music, once they heard the blues that he found so transcendent, so beautiful, and so profound, that mainstream audience, and you can read for that a white audience, would find it impossible to resist the power of the music, the beauty of the music, and that at that point, the music would break down the walls of segregation, at the very least within the musical world. I don't think he extrapolated that to break down the walls of segregation everywhere, and that was his greater goal from the very start.
How did he think he was going to make money doing that?
He didn't know. He had no business plan. I mean, he what he had as a business plan was the idea that he would do anything to keep his studio working, to keep his studio going. And for that reason, he recorded weddings, he recorded funerals, he recorded talent shows, he recorded bar mitzvahs, he recorded the sound of an automobile exhaust in a lawsuit brought against the city of Memphis's anti-noise laws. So he would do anything to keep the studio open, but the purpose of the studio was to record that African-American music. Now, the corollary question to it, which I'm sure you were just about to ask, is how did he get these great black musicians to come into the studio? And that he had no plan for either. I mean, other than, you know, the plan that we all have, which is networking. But, you know, how do you network with a community that you really are not part of and you don't know? But Sam was a very he was inventive. He was resourceful, and he also was could take advantage of whatever life brought him, whatever it was that came his way. And while he was still in the process of building the studio with his assistant amanuensis, a woman who worked at the radio station in Memphis where he worked, WREC, Marion Keisker, who was utterly devoted to doing anything she could to further Sam's dream. While they were in the studio, a one-man band named Joe Hill Lewis, who played on Beale Street and was the most congenial of people. I mean, I wish I had known him. I mean, he just sounds like this, the most gregarious and outgoing kind of person. He wandered in. He said, "What are you doing?" Sam explained it to him. Joe Hill Lewis said, "That's just what we need. That's just what Memphis needs, a recording studio." He then left the studio, and it was really through Joe Hill Lewis in those early months of 1950 when there was no other business. Joe Hill Lewis went out into the black community, into the blues community, and brought back people he knew like Walter Horton and Jack Kelly, an old jug band performer, And that's really how it started, essentially. And then Sam also looked for labels that might be willing to pick up the music that he was recording in the studio. He had no interest in starting a label. I think he saw his mission as really devoted to the purity of the music and recording the music. And so he ran into a couple of labels. And the second one, the Modern label, which was owned by the Bahari Brothers in L.A., that was how he started recording B.B. King for the Bahari Brothers in the summer of 1950.
I'm going to play a little sample of some B.B. King, and this is She's Dynamite.
She'll show you how if you just tell her when. She's dynamite. She's dynamite. She knows what to do and she knows what it's all about. Love me more. She carries a pearl hound, pistol, a knife, and a razor, too. You don't tell her nothing, she'll always tell you she's dynamite. She's dynamite. She knows what to do, and she knows what it's all about.
Any reaction to She's Dynamite?
Well, I think, you know, for the casual listener, you might be surprised to hear B.B. King performing in that fashion. And I think B.B. King himself was surprised to find himself recording in that fashion. In many ways, that is the vision that Sam had for what would later, what would one day be called rock and roll. B.B. recorded that just after Rocket 80, after Sam had recorded Rocket 88 by Ike Turner and his Kings of Rhythm, who were known on the record as Jackie Brenson and his Delta Cats. And Rocket 88 was the first big success Sam had in May and June of 51. It went to number one on the R&B charts. It just destroyed the country. And it's often been called the first rock and roll record, which, like, who invented rock and roll is a specious question, one that there is no real answer to. But as much as anything, this could be seen as the first rock and roll record. And you can hear in She's Dynamite by B.B. King the same kind of impulse that Sam had to have this driving beat. He had the great piano player, Calvin Newborn was the guitarist, and this is Phineas Newborn Jr. playing this great jazz player, but you've been here, he's playing this great boogie-woogie driving piano. And Sam saw this as the kind of music he truly believed this was going to go to number one on the charts, the pop charts, not just the R&B charts. I mean, with Ike Turner, with Rocket 88, he had just sold 100,000 copies on Chess Records. He had hooked up with Chess Records by now, and they had sold 100,000 copies within the R&B market, but that's an extraordinary sale. And I think, and he spoke in the papers at that time how he believed this record, Rocket 88, in the spring of 51, was not going to be limited to the R&B market. This was a record for everyone. This was a record for the pop market. Now, that was a prophecy that didn't come true. But with this B.B. King thing, he had recorded a number of fairly pallid B.B. King blues before this. And with this, he put B.B. into the same kind of mode that he had recorded Rocket 88 in. And I just think, man, I just think it's one of the most exciting things in the world. But it wasn't really the direction B.B. King wanted to go in. Sam and the Bahari split right after that, and B.B. King in the fall recorded 3 O'Clock Blues, which is just a classic song and is much more along the lines of what B.B. King saw for himself. But Sam saw for B.B. King, whom he considered, you know, whom he regarded very, very highly. He saw him just as he saw Ike Turner, and he saw Howlin' Wolf as having the capacity to reach this larger, this mainstream audience with a music that would just blow everybody away.
We're talking with Peter Guralnick about Sun Studios. This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking with Peter Guralnick about music producer Sam Phillips and his landmark Memphis studio Sun Records hold a unique place in the history of rock and roll by many accounts. Before Phillips recorded Rocket 88 by Ike Turner and Jackie Brinson and his Delta Cats in 1951, rock and roll as we know it didn't even exist. Now let's listen to Rocket 88.
You've heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight, just one way. Everybody likes my Rocket 88. Baby, we'll ride in style, moving all along. Smart and designed, black convertible top, and the gals don't mind. Sporting with me, riding all around town for joy. Blow your horn, Raymond, blow! In my rocket and don't be late, baby, we're pulling out about 8:30. Going round the corner and get a bill. Everybody in my car's gonna take a little nip. Move on out, oozing and cruising along.
There were so many other different sounds coming out of the Sun Studios in Memphis, Tennessee, written about by Peter Guralnick. He is the author of Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll. I don't want to get too far ahead. There's so much stuff happening in this phase of Sam Phillips' career, like Little Milton, Begging My Baby. So who is Little Milton?
Well, Little Milton was a blues singer, a very young blues singer from Mississippi named Milton Campbell. A wonderful guy who had a long career, ended up recording soul music or R&B for Chess Records, and eventually great, great blues and soul for Stax Records. At the time he was recording for Sam, he really didn't have a style, and I can't remember whom he was imitating in Begging My Baby, but all of his records on Sun were essentially imitations of stars of the day, like Fats Domino would be one. And Little Milton was somebody who... A very bright, very perspicacious, to use a word that Sam would use, young man, somebody who observed everything around him, somebody who appreciated the opportunity he was giving him, he was being given, somebody who appreciated Sam and had a greater knowledge of him than I think many of the other blues and R&B singers on the label, but somebody who at the time was just looking for a style of his own, and Sam was doing his best to bring that style out of him.
How did he do that? What was he, would he just say, try this, try that?
No, in many ways, it was a matter of patience. I mean, it was, when he first brought Howlin' Wolf into the studio, for example, when he heard Howlin' Wolf on the radio in a very bad connection from West Memphis on KWEM, he just listened to it through all the crackle and pop, and he said to himself, I said to myself, this is it. This is where the soul of man never dies. Now, that was the pinnacle of everything Sam ever did. Sam Wolf was the most profound artist that he ever encountered and ever would encounter, and probably the one artist that if he had to choose whom he would record till the end of his life, it would have been Howlin' Wolf. But when he brought Wolf into the studio, his method was much the same as it was with many other artists, the same as it was with Elvis. It was to sit there patiently to allow the artist to discover or to seek out and try different things, to get relaxed in the studio, to feel at home in the studio, while Sam fooled around in the control room, you know, acting as if he were preoccupied with something. But when he heard something, when he heard the artist fix on something, when he heard the artist in a state of not just relaxation, in a state of relaxed intensity or intense relaxation, when, you know, having transcended self-consciousness, that was when he said, now that's it, that's what I want. And really, that was the kind of thing. He wasn't interested in giving direction. He was interested in bringing out of each artist the uniqueness that he sensed was in every one of them. I mean, Sam prided himself on his ability to read people, and he was extraordinary in his ability to read people on first acquaintance. He got a very good sense of them. He did say about Howlin' Wolf, who was a man of few words, he said about Wolf, as much as I was reading the wolf was reading me much more. But he sensed what their uniqueness was, whether it was Johnny Cash or it was Howlin' Wolf or it was Dr. Ross. He sensed something that they had to offer. He sensed in Elvis Presley an absolutely unique talent, but he had no idea how it was going to express itself. And he simply wanted to give it the opportunity to express himself. He might never issue a record on this person, but he was willing to wait and wait and wait for that moment, and maybe offer little suggestions, move the microphones around just to become part of the process, also because he prided himself on his ear, and he believed that microphone placement was as much the key to getting the sound as anything else. But most of all, he considered himself in the business of soul exploration, and he really wanted to give each person the opportunity to express themselves in a different way. He had zero interest, unlike, let's say, a producer like Phil Spector or a producer like Rick Hall in Muscle Shoals. He didn't have an end in mind. It wasn't as if there was no one sound that he wanted to hear coming out of the studio.
Now, you write in a book that Sam Phillips' father knew how to work with mules. He didn't need a whip or a stick. He knew how to get the mules to work. Was this the gene that Sam Phillips inherited?
Sam admired his father so much, and he referred to him as the quietest stick of dynamite you would ever find. So I think you're right. I mean, I never thought of it like that, but I mean, in a sense, it was that quiet intensity that I think he did acquire from his father. His father had a feel for the land in every way, not just working with mules. He terraced, he landscaped land. He had a feel for, it's more than a green thumb. He identified with the land. He identified himself as one with the land. This is Sam's father. And that wasn't something that Sam sought out for himself, but it was something he very much admired in his father. And I think that sense of total immersion, total identification, was one that he carried into his work. I mean, I never considered that. That's a very apt observation.
Let's listen to some Howlin' Wolf. This is Moaning at Midnight. Thank you.
my door.
This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We'll be right back after this NPR news break. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're speaking with Peter Guralnick. He's the author of the book, Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll, How One Man Discovered Howlin' Wolf, Ike Turner, Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, and Elvis Presley, and how his tiny label, Sun Records of Memphis, revolutionized the world. Let's talk about Elvis Presley. He wandered into the studio, wanted to make a record for his mother, supposedly, and that's how rock and roll history was made.
Elvis was among the most ambitious and artistically driven people, I think, who ever came into the Sun Studio. On the same level as far as ambition goes with Jerry Lee Lewis, with Johnny Cash, with Howlin' Wolf, with Ike Turner. He came into the studio because he read a story in the paper in the summer of 1953. About a group, a quintet that Sam had just recorded called The Prisoners, who were five prisoners in the Tennessee State Penitentiary in Nashville. And the article, as well as detailing the Prisoners' session, their first session where they recorded Just Crying in the Rain, which was a big hit for the time in R&B, an even bigger hit a couple of years later for Johnny Ray on the pop charts, and just an extraordinarily moving record. But in the course of the reporter who wrote up the story, he spoke with the proprietor of the studio, Mr. Phillips, and described how Sam Phillips was open to talent of any kind, not just conventional talent. He was looking for something different. He wasn't looking for established stars. He was looking for people who had never been in the studio before. He was looking for a different sound. And that was what Elvis read. And Elvis was just graduated from high school. He was 18 years old. This called to him in a sense. So he went in there to make what was called a personal record, which means he or you or I or anybody else could go in there, pay $4 and get a two-sided acetate, essentially a two-sided 78, only one copy made just for us, and we paid for it. And that's what Elvis did. He paid for it. Now, everything he did was for his mother on a certain level. So you could say he was making it for his mother, but the real reason was he was trying to put himself in the way of discovery. It's like a kid playing baseball, and imagining the major league scouts are out there looking at him. And that was what Elvis hoped, was that this man, Sam Phillips, would discover him, said, "Son, you've got something that nobody else has ever shown me. I'm going to make you a star," which is not Sam Phillips' style, but that's just a fantasy description. But nothing happened. I mean, it took almost a year before Sam finally called him to come back into the studio to try a song which he had gotten, again, from the Tennessee State Prison, State Penitentiary, but wanted to hear somebody record it, and he brought Elvis in, and that was a failure, too. But shortly after that, he set up Elvis with a guitarist, Scotty Moore, acting as a kind of talent scout for Sun Records, which he had started the year before. and try out this kid, see how he sounds. And Elvis had the tryout, and Sam asked Scotty, what do you think? And Scotty said, well, I guess we could, it'd be worth having an audition session in the studio. You know, it didn't really, you know, I wasn't that knocked out, but it was good, it was fine. And so Elvis came into the studio with the guitarist Scotty Moore and with Bill Black, the bass player whom Scotty was working with in another group. And they played for most of the evening doing ballads, which was what Elvis was drawn to. I mean, doing some Ink Spots ballads, doing an Eddie Arnold song, doing a Dean Martin song, maybe doing a Perry Como song. And in this, Sam continued to sense this unique ability to communicate. I think that's really the thing that made Elvis stand out the most. It wasn't that he had the greatest voice. It wasn't the way he looked. It was he had this unique capacity for communication. But Sam didn't hear anything that, you know, he could put out on the market. And the session seemed pretty much like a failure. All three of them had to go to work the next day. It was getting late. They took a break. Scotty and Bill were drinking Cokes. And Elvis, in what I would say was, you know, just an act of desperation, picked up his guitar and started, you could say, either flailing or frailing away on it, playing a song that was unlike anything he had sung in the studio to that point, playing the blues song, That's All Right Mama by Arthur Big Boy Crudup. And Scotty and Bill fell in. They started playing behind him. They didn't really know what they were doing, but they just started playing behind him. And Sam just immediately snapped, too. He was just in the control room messing around or something. He says, what's that you're playing? Scotty said, I don't know. And Sam said, well, whatever it is, go back to the beginning, start all over and do it again. And that was the genesis of Elvis's career. But it was, and there again, it was Sam's patience, his willingness to wait for something that he was certain existed but was not sure what manifestation it would take, that created this accidental moment. He didn't create Elvis Presley. Elvis Presley created Elvis Presley. And the music that Elvis Presley listened to. I mean, if it was anybody who knew every realm of music, it was Elvis, it was Jerry Lee Lewis, and they might as well have been called ethnomusicologists without a degree. But the point is that Elvis found that note, and he hit it, and Sam immediately snapped to it.
Sam Phillips took the acetate of the record of That's All Right Mama and took it over to Dewey Phillips, who was the DJ, the big disc jockey for the area, and right. He played it, and it was a hit?
Well, it couldn't sell any, but they didn't have a record.
But it was popular.
I mean, Dewey Phillips, we should say, I suppose you could say it was a turntable hit because they got call after call and telegram after telegram about it, but Dewey Phillips was as close to Sam as anybody in the world. I mean, they were closer than brothers, Sam sometimes said. And Sam was a fairly solitary person who had maybe five or six really close friends over the course of his lifetime, and Dewey was definitely one of them. But, no, the success of That's All Right, this one-sided acetate, is actually what led Sam to realize he had to record another song right away so he could get the record out so he could have a hit.
Right. So I want to talk about that when we come back. It's Painting the Mustache on the Mona Lisa. What does that mean? We're going to come back from the break and talk about Blue Moon on Kentucky. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking with Peter Guralnick about his book, Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll. Before the break, we were talking about Blue Moon of Kentucky. Let's hear a cut from that before we get back to our interview.
Blue Moon, Blue Moon, Blue Moon, keep shining bright. Blue Moon, keep on shining bright. You're gonna bring me back on my baby tonight. Blue Moon, keep shining bright. I say Blue Moon of Kentucky, you keep on shining. Shine on the one that's gone and left me blue. I say Blue Moon of Kentucky, you keep on shining.
This was a much-loved song in the end, and Bill Monroe, and it is and giving it the Elvis treatment, like I said, was like painting the mustache on the Mona Lisa. Why did they do that?
Well, I'm not sure what that painting the mustache on the Mona Lisa is.
The way I see it is that this was an icon of a song, and then suddenly for Elvis to start giving it this kind of a rockabilly treatment, it was like a statement in and of itself that they were going to that they were challenging certain concepts.
Well, to a degree, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I mean, in a sense, iconic didn't mean anything to either Sam or Elvis. Each of them prized originality. Each of them prized what Sam called individualism, and then he would say, in the extreme, you know. And that was what he prized most of all. Both of them cherished Blue Moon of Kentucky, which was a waltz by Bill Monroe and his Bluegrass Boys, and which had, I don't know that iconic status could apply to anything at that time. You know, when you, it's sort of like saying an R&B hit might have sold 25 or 30,000 copies. Blue Moon of Kentucky probably didn't sell any more. But you know, Bill Monroe bestrode the world of bluegrass, which he had actually invented to all intents and purposes a few years earlier, 1946. But it was a song that all loved. Elvis and Scotty and Bill approached it, did it as a solid 4-4 beat, did it as a driving instrumental. I'm not convinced, in a way, that Sam was as sold on the song as he said he was in later years, or as he appeared to be. And the difference is that if you listen to That's All Right, Sam applied none of the repetitive echo that he used, that he had developed. It's called slapback, and it's sort of an echo that chases the original sound, and you can control how closely it chases it or how far apart it is. There's no slapback, which is Sam's characteristic sound on Sun on That's All Right, and I think it was because he considered it so beautiful and to have such a purity of feeling that it didn't require anything else. So there's slapback all over Blue Moon of Kentucky, and I've often felt that as much as Sam prized perfect imperfection, that here the imperfection was a little too much for him. One other thing, you know, to go back to your Picasso, Mona Lisa thing, is that as Elvis also recorded Blue Moon of Kentucky, or started it anyway, as a slow blues. So, I mean, they were just fooling around with different, I think in some ways what they were trying to do was to recapture the feel that they got on That's All Right, Mama. And in some ways they did, in some ways they didn't. But in terms of the world and in terms of history, they definitely did. And in terms of, I guess, my ultimate reaction, they definitely did, because I love Blue Moon of Kentucky. But then, with that song completed, the night after they did That's All Right, Sam could get the record pressed and get it out within a week or 10 days. And That's All Right just became the biggest thing in Memphis. I mean, kids were going, you know, up and down the street saying, repeating the sort of scat thing, da-da-da-da-da-da-dee-da-da-da-da. I can't say it, but that was part of the song. And it had been part of Arthur Big Wig Crudup's song. And Elvis started playing club dates. He was somebody who basically played in his bedroom. You know, he's somebody who practiced in front of the mirror until he had this audition session at Sun. He got to put on a big country and western show at Overton Park, headlined by Slim Whitman. He really went over big there. He started playing at a club called the Clearpool, first as a kind of intermission act, and his career took off from there. But it didn't take off. It took off, and yet it didn't take off. It didn't take off nationally in any way. It went from Memphis to a little bit of the Mid-South into Arkansas. Eventually, Sam got him on the Grand Ole Opry in September for a one-day show, which he thought was important to expose Elvis to the nation, to the world. Then he got him on the Louisiana Hayride, starting, I think, in October. And that's where Elvis really made his mark and started reaching out to Texas and Oklahoma and all over the place through this 50,000-watt clear channel station.
What about Elvis the Pelvis? His stage performance was so controversial at the time. Did Sam Phillips have anything to do with that or any reaction to it?
No, but actually it wasn't controversial at the time. It was only controversial when Elvis became nationally known, and when cardinals and monsignors and priests and politicians could make a little hay off of, and journalists too, could make a little hay off of criticizing somebody who was getting more attention than they were. But in terms of Elvis drew his principal inspiration from the bass singer for the Statesman. It was a guy named, Jim Big Chief Wetherington, and who kept his leg going the whole time, caused a little bit of scandal, was denounced to a limited extent by jealous other quartets that might be jealous, or some ministers. But basically, he was a gospel singer. He was totally a gospel singer, and this was the person that Elvis took his greatest inspiration from in the beginning. if you look at films of Elvis performing, there aren't many, but if you look at him performing at a place outside of Houston, I can't remember the name of it, you see the audience. It's an all-ages audience, and when Elvis goes into his, you know, stage movements, people are just, they just are digging it. They're just laughing about it. Little kids are laughing. The parents are laughing. There just was literally no controversy until he became a national figure. And this should be a lesson to all of us. Never become a national figure because they'll just start shooting at you.
This is another Elvis song. This is Baby, Let's Play House.
Baby, 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 baby. Come back, baby. I want to play house with you.
Well, you may go to college. You may go to school. You may have a pink Cadillac, but don't you be nobody's fool. And now, baby, come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, I want to play house with you. Well, listen, let me tell you, baby, what I'm talking about. Come on back to me, little girl, so we can play some house. And now, baby, come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, I want to play house with you.
All in the house, baby.
So Sam Phillips had Elvis under contract. What kind of contract was that?
Oh, it was, you know, standard contract. I can't remember how long, how much more time it was. Probably a 2-year contract, and you know, with a 3% royalty.
And
pretty much a normal contract.
But he sold it for $35,000.
Well, yeah, because Elvis at the time that he sold the contract. Now $35,000 doesn't sound like much money. You know, you could buy a very nice house for $35,000. It was the most money ever paid for a single act up until that time. And Frankie Lane, for example, who was a huge pop star, his contract had been sold a few years earlier for $25,000. That was the record up till then. But the reason Sam sold the contract was basically because he was going bankrupt. Anybody who's ever contemplated or had a small independent label of their own will know that the worst thing that can ever happen to you is a hit. And the reason, and a hit has put more small labels out of business. Now, it's not the same business model today, but at that time and for many years thereafter, the reason that a hit was more likely to put you out of business than it was to increase your bankroll was because you had to pay all of your costs up front. You had to pay manufacturing costs, you had to pay the pressing plant, all of that money had to be paid up front. Then, if the record sold, you had to keep getting the record pressed and had continuing manufacturing costs. You still had to pay all that up front. The challenge was, how do you get your money from the distributors? And unless you had another record coming down the chute, you were very unlikely to get paid by your distributors. They say, why should I give my hard-earned money to somebody who isn't going to be in business for another 6 months? And, I mean, a clear example of this is Scotty Moore, Elvis's guitarist, after he had left Elvis, started a label called Fernwood. He had one huge hit called Tragedy by Thomas Wayne. It was a tremendous hit. That was the last record that he put out. I mean, the hit put him out of business. So in Sam's case, he's on the verge of going bankrupt. He never wanted to be a one-artist label. He had no interest in that at all. He wasn't in the management business. He wasn't interested in managing Elvis's career. He couldn't have done that. And with the $35,000 he got, well, first of all, he got, in addition to $35,000, he got $5,000, which paid off the back royalties he owed to Elvis, which he kept a meticulous record of, but he didn't have the money to pay that any more than he had the money to pay the excise tax, which is a key part of the record business at that time. So with the $35,000, he could establish his own label. He recorded the record, Blue Suede Shoes by Kyle Perkins, in the immediate aftermath of selling it. He went out on the road. Selling Carol Perkins' success was really the template for rock and roll because it hit the top of the charts of the all three charts, country, R&B, and pop, the first record ever to do that. And Sam Phillips was finally on his way, but it was with the money he got from selling Elvis's contract.
So Carl Perkins, he was already in the Sam Phillips stable, but he was not rockabilly.
No, and nor did he. I can't remember whether he had a record out on Sun. He had a He may have had a record out on Sun, but he had a couple out on Flip, which was almost an audition label. And he was just somebody that Sam recognized, again, as having this unique talent. In many ways, Sam felt that his greatest talent was in the Hank Williams mold. From Sam's point of view, the uniqueness of his talent was the jump that he gave to his records and the jump that, through his guitar. I mean, it's just an extraordinary rhythmic sense. And you spoke earlier of the first rock and roll record. Well, you could point to Strange Things Happening by Sister Rosetta Tharpe, which came out, I think, around 46 or so. It was a gospel number, but you could point to that in many ways as being the first rockabilly record anyway. I mean, the jump that she has in her guitar. Now, Carl Perkins knew of Sister Rosetta Tharpe's recordings, as did Elvis, Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, Sleepy LaBeef, everybody, and was inspired by them. But it's not that he's trying to sound like her, but it's that rhythmic jump, just that way in which the music just will not stay still, that I think gives Carl Perkins' music his mark, just as Sister Rosetta's mark is almost music is almost unparalleled. I mean, everybody should go out and listen to Sister Rosetta Tharpe right now.
Well, let's check out some Carl Perkins. This is Honey Don't.
You say you will when you won't. You tell me you do, baby, when you don't. Let me know, honey, how you feel. Tell the truth now, is love real? Oh, honey, don't. Well, honey, don't. Honey, don't. No, honey, don't. Hey, honey, don't. Say you will when you won't. Baby, and you ought to know, I like the way that you wear your clothes. Everything about you is so doggone sweet. You got that sand all over your feet. So, hey, honey, don't.
Honey Don't is just—it's really a straight-ahead boogie-woogie number, you know, translated onto guitar. And again, it has that infectious rhythm that, you know, that Carl specialized in. That was really Carl's mark. And there are all kinds of songs like that. All Mama's Children is a great song. Boppin' the Blues, I think, is even better. But they all have that kind of what I would say is that celebration of life, that joyousness. I mean, Sam was about as positive a person as I've ever met. He wasn't interested in the dark and gloomy, even though he himself suffered from depression all his life. But he was interested, in a sense, in celebrating life. And so much of the music, Carl Perkins' music, Jerry Lee Lewis's music, so much of the music reflected that bent.
All right. Peter Guralnick is the author of Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll, How One Man Discovered Howlin' Wolf, Ike Turner, Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, and Elvis Presley, How His Tiny Label, Sun Records of Memphis, Revolutionized the World. Peter, it was great talking with you.
Well, it was great talking to you. Thanks so much.
And this is The Source on KSTX. Thanks for tuning us in.